I'm happy with it.
May 12th, 2009.
Okay, my name is Steve McCarthy. I'd like to welcome everybody tonight to the annual or the monthly meeting of the Lincoln Minutemen, which we call a muster. Stop calling it a muster in the paper because people think they might have to show up with their muskets, but that's our term for it. Our captain, Ruth Hodges, is out of town, so she asked me to introduce our speaker, which I'm happy to do. And also, I'd like to welcome guests that might not be members of the company. If you'd like to introduce yourselves, that would be fine, or how you heard about us, or where you're from. Or maybe we'll all give our names. Jim, you can say what you do in the company.
Jim Hogan, Black Powder Safety, and a little bit of history.
I'm Tom Moore. I was at John's excellent presentation at Hibernian Hall, and I'm actually recording this tonight for my podcast, Midnight Ride, and I do have some business cards that people like history as much as I do.
Okay, you're welcome to hand those out.
George Roberts, I'm a musket man with the Lincoln Minutemen and the quartermaster, and I've seen John a number of times. You're in for a real treat tonight.
I'm Doug Uncle, I'm a musket, also with the Lincoln Minutemen, and I agree with what George has said about John's presentation. So
they're all bought and paid for on this side of the table, all four of them.
And we'll move to the back behind
David here. Blackwell, Groveland, Mass. I scan an old, out of copyright, World of History books. I have about a couple hundred on DVDs. If anybody's interested, they can get them from me. Websites, I've had them on bust, and they're no longer online. One of the histories I scanned in, and actually OCR'd, was the history of Portland, Maine.
Wow.
By Willis, and that's online at Wikipedia, linked into the Portland, Maine webpage at the bottom, and it's actually at archive.org, the archive, the USGS.
Dave, I have a moratorium for my wife. No more books in the house, but we can smuggle something in electronically.
Right. That's my problem as well.
Thank you, Dave.
I'm Kathleen Moore, and this is my son Jackson Otto, and we're new members. So,
great, welcome.
Jackson is in the Middlesex County 4-H.
Alan?
Alan Budrow, musket man. Bob Lennington, musket man. Andy Sheff, colonial.
Francis Wentworth, and I carry the musket, but I graduated from musician groupie to apprentice drummer, so.
Diane Perry, I went to the first history festival, and I'm in New England Churchill.
Okay.
Kat Pasek. I know about this. My good buddy Diane. And I'm also have a moratorium on the house, no more books.
Okay, so our speaker tonight is John Horgan. We're proud that he's a member of our company. He is a musket man and also a local historian and folklorist. And I'm sure you've heard good things from everyone else, so I don't need to answer that. We move on to the show. Please feel free to, if there are drinks here, I see if someone can maybe pass that around. A little heavy, or I'll carry it around. How's that? And cookies. And John, why don't you start? And I'll just. And there's ice there if people want juice. Has anyone had a chance to shoot a can if they don't want juice or seltzer?
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. And special thanks to Steve McCarthy for coordinating this and for putting this lecture up. So I really appreciate the opportunity. As Steve mentioned, my name is John Horrigan, a musket man of the Lincoln Minutemen. I research historical fires, historical weather, and just folklore in general. And if you don't mind, I'm going to sit down tonight. We're in a round table or a square table style, and I think it's kind of cool, so I'm going to probably drive it from here. I've got some cards for the New England Save the Date New England History Festival. I think there's about four of you. I think Dave, Larry, Francis, Doug, I don't know if you had one, Alan. So if you could pass those around, it's Saturday, November 14th. Alan was there last year representing the Lincoln Minutemen and had the outstanding exhibitor because he came in the last minute and set up his exhibit in a minute.
And I just happened to have the award we got, which should go to Lincoln Archives, and a picture of the exhibit I set up.
Great. Just want to mention one thing. I'm a professional sports announcer with the Boston Bruins alumni and New England Patriots alumni. So if I break out quickly in speaking, I'm paid to do that, and plus this is a three-game night. We have the Sox playing, then the Celtics, and the Bruins in a playoff game. The Bruins are leading 2-0. My history sites, ushistory.me, ushistory.biz, americanhistory.biz. I urge you all to join. Go on to meetup.com and join the New England History Group. You get in, you get mega discounts to the History Festival, and then I put in different lectures around there. And anybody that joins the group can advertise their personal lectures. And feel free tonight to jump in on anything that we mention here tonight. This is about an hour lecture. I'm only going to go for 35 or 40 minutes, and I'm going to rely on Steve, to give me the 5 minutes, okay, to wrap up.
Hey, John, before you go, is it possible to turn off that light in front
of
the screen?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, if we want to, we can do that. If we can,
use this floor
thanks,
and,
for the ambiance, and then we'll just turn off.
Where is the
I think it's right there in the back.
No. Great, thank you, Alan. Thank you, Francis, for mentioning that. Beautiful. We're going to talk about the fire of the colonies tonight. Early fires of the Revolution, and again, this is time permitting, fires that sparked the American Revolution, major fires of the American Revolution, other great fires of the Revolution, great campfires of the Revolution, and a dark day, and then finally a traitor returns. I've juxtaposed the order of this slide, so we may not get to great campfires, and I'll go over the dark day quickly. So the fire of the colonies, fire is used for survival, as a farming tool, as a siege weapon, as a foe, fire as propaganda, and colonial firefighting. So in this segment, I want to go over some of those. Fire for survival, well, it's a primary energy source, especially in colonial days. And it's utilized for cooking, heat, light, and energy, saying home is where the hearth is. Fireplace was central to home and family life. The fire was part of the family and demanded attention like a child. Survival was dependent upon maintaining warmth and staying dry. That is so important. To stay warm and dry during these times, or you'd get sick. Wood, whale oil in the 19th century, and coal were the cores of a consistent fire. Wood stocks had to be managed effectively to drive you through the winter season. And fire safety and precautionary measures, ventilation, disposal of embers, etc., were inherent to any household. Now, it was also used as a farming tool in slash and burn agriculture. It was used to clear land for farming. In autumn, you'd chop trees halfway at waist level and topple them onto one another in a domino effect. Then you burn them in late spring. When the first settlers came here in the early 17th century, they weren't rolling farmlands. They were forested areas. There were two benefits to doing this. You'd clear land, and the ash from burning these trees was a great fertilizer. And this caused a dark day in New England on May 19th, 1780. I've done that lecture here for the Lincoln Minutemen last year. But it's an interesting anomaly in the history of the American Revolution. And as I mentioned, most land in the 17th century in New England was covered by forest. Unfortunately, today slash and burn is destroying most of the Amazon and tropical rainforests of Indonesia. These trees are the lungs of the earth. What about fire as a siege weapon? Well, fire was the first terror weapon. And it was utilized as an offensive weapon during the siege of Syracuse by Archimedes, who allegedly used a burning glass to set the Roman warships afire. The Romans used trebuchets to fling fire gobs at fortresses. Invading armies would burn villages to the ground. Fire rafts were used in the War of 1812 and in the Revolutionary War. The Allies used incendiary bombs on Japan and Germany. It was used as a defensive measure. Washington and Alexander the Great used dummy campfires to conceal nighttime maneuvers. In Washington's case, the retreat. Moscow was set ablaze by its residents to foil Napoleon. And the Iraqi Republican Guard set oil wells afire. Accidental or natural fire as a foe. Well, lightning is the number one culprit. Lightning still is the major cause of forest fires. Carelessness in discarding cigarettes or unattended campfires also cause major fires, but it's wafting sparks and wind. And you'll see some of the cities that burn tonight during the American Revolution. The conflagration explodes due to wind. And then, of course, electrical fires are caused by electrical heaters and old wiring in houses. And the other thing was that in colonial times, there was instantaneous ignition. In fact, smoking was banned outdoors for a while because of the wind was blowing sparks, so that how ironic is it that smoking was only permitted indoors at Plymouth Plantation for a time? Wind, rather than carelessness, was the culprit of most early American fires. And aside from disease, the biggest killer in a village was a floating ember that was fanned to flame. A village could be reduced to ash with one errant spark, and a thatched roof on a wooden house was a fuse waiting to be lit. course, there were building codes and zoning laws that came into play, of course, after any major fire. There was a lack of regulation. The absence of building codes and consequently structures were built with flammable components like straw, dried wood. There were no zoning laws, and therefore houses and buildings, especially in cities, could be built almost on top of one another. And regulations would only be instituted, as I mentioned, after a terrible fire had taken place. And then what we're going to see tonight is fire used as propaganda, destroying something symbolically. What's frightening is this is only 70 years ago, and everyone enjoys a nice book burning. In fact, Nazi book burnings were one of the only social outlets in Hitler-occupied Germany. Fritz, are you going to the book burning tonight? Yes, I'm taking Gretel. Bonfires emphasized a political stance. Colonists would burn an effigy or they'd burn tea stalks. And attacking armies always set villages ablaze. So colonial firefighting, immediate reaction to the alarm is essential. Most households would have a ladder, a broom, and a bucket. And speed was the key to fighting fires in early America. All must answer the bell, the church bell. No traditional organized firefighting units or apparatus were available. Some village ordinances decreed that each household must possess a bucket, a ladder, a long pole with a swab, and a broom. All males must respond to the ringing of the church bell. And I'll just deviate here. In New York City, all of this was sabotaged. You'll see later, they removed church bells, they sabotaged buckets and wells, so when a fire broke out, that the British couldn't fight it. And then the bucket brigade would form at the well and stretch towards the inferno and back.
The well of the place on fire?
Good question. Can anybody field that? I can't give you a specific answer on that, but there would be one town center well, obviously, that was for public use. I'm sure other colonies well off would have additional wells, and people would have their private wells, but I'm not sure. That's a very good question. I know that there would be one in the center, and that was also a social gathering place as well. Anybody? Okay. Early fires of the American Revolution. I'm going to look into that. The Stamp Act, yes, Tom.
I have a little one for the ladies that I picked up at the Noah Webster House. When women would cook over their open hearths, when they would get burned, even a small burn could kill you because it could get infected, and there was no penicillin or antibiotics. So I think that actually kitchen burns from over a fire were like the second deadliest cause of death in women. I'm not sure what the first one was. Maybe childbirth, yes, that makes sense. But so fire could kill you rather easily back then with infected burns.
My wife was looking at a hearth, a colonial hearth, and said, I could cook on that. And so she's from Spokane, Washington. In the early fires, we're going to look at the Stamp Act effigies, the false alarm gone bad, and great tea burnings. The Stamp Act, as you know, took place in 1765. On August 14th of that year, after a tax was imposed by Parliament on the colonies to help pay for troops stationed in North America following the British victory in the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War. Well, on August 14th, 1765, Andrew Oliver, a distributor of stamps from Massachusetts, was hung in effigy, a dummy was hung, from a giant elm tree at the crossing of Essex and Orange Street in the city's south end. This would be known as the Liberty Tree later. So Sheriff Greenleaf is ordered by Lieutenant Governor Thomas Hutchinson to take the effigy down. But he was opposed by such a large crowd who detoured merchants on Orange Street, and they had their own goods symbolically stamped under the elm tree, later known as the Liberty Tree. At night, a mob led by Ebenezer McIntosh, a Seven Years' War veteran and also a shoemaker and just a rabble-rouser, cut down the effigy and took it in a funeral procession to the townhouse where the legislature was meeting. And then they went to Oliver's office, tore it down, and then took the effigy to Oliver's home where they beheaded it and then burned the effigy, along with Oliver's stable house and coach and chaise. The sheriff and Hutchinson were stoned when they tried to stop the mob, which then proceeded to loot and destroy the contents of Oliver's house. And then they went up the road to Hutchinson's. Jim.
Going back to that group of citizens that were at the corner of Essex and Orange Street, they belong to a local civic association, which still exists today, the South Boston Citizens Association.
When you say they were stoned, people were throwing stones.
That's correct. We are clarifying that. Although there was hemp, plenty of hemp in the colonies. Yes, Dave.
One of the things the British did before this, actually, was prohibit the printing of colonial money. And because they prohibited the printing of colonial money, there was a great deflationary period just before the American Revolutionary War. And that really caused a lot of economic distress and promoted this difficulty that the colonials had with Britain.
And that was the beginning in 1776, though, of the grand super cycle, which preceded the Industrial Revolution of the 19th century. Stamp Act again, October 24th in New York. Stamps for several of the northern colonies arrived in New York Harbor on ships. Placards stated, though, the first man that either distributes or makes use of stamp paper, let him take care of his house, person, and effects. In other words, if you're caught using these stamps, you're going to get it from the colonists. So there was a boycott of English goods until the Stamp Act was repealed. And there's a mock parade here down below. Of course, the fatal stamp. Unruly mobs took to the streets for 4 days of demonstrations, culminating with 2,000 people attacking Governor Colden's home and burning 2 slaves and a coach. So fire as a propaganda weapon. And when we look at the Boston Massacre, I use the Stamp Act as basically the precursor to the American Revolution. But the bloody massacre that took place on March 5th, 1770, and I always love this. Do you know about the secret gun? This is Paul Revere's engraving, but do you see the mystery gun up there out of the window? But basically, when the ringing of the bells came, citizens were supposed that a fire was in progress, and they thought it was in progress on King Street. And they brought e-buckets and saw the mob near the old State House. And I just started watching, there were 11 shot and 5 died, just started watching John Adams and Paul Giamatti. Boy, can he act. And I was taken by the fact that fire, they hear fire yelling, it's the mob yelling at the British to tell them to fire at us. Come on, you bloody backs, fire at us. But he grabs his bucket, they ring the church bell, they think it's a fire, when in actuality it's a mob inciting them to fire. And basically fire started the Boston Massacre. You see, the Boston Tea Party, there was no fire involved in this action of December 16th, 1773. But what people don't understand is there are several other tea parties that took place. First of them was on May 10th, 1773, to keep the troubled East India Company afloat. Parliament gave them a bailout. They passed the Tea Act, taxing all tea in the American colonies. So what people don't remember is in Lexington, a few days prior to the Boston Tea Raid, as I call it, the inhabitants met and resolved not to use tea of any sort, no matter where it come from, and to show their sincerity, they brought together every ounce contained in the town and committed it to one common bonfire. In Annapolis, October 14, 1774, an action similar to the one in Boston. The British East India Company tea ship is anchored at Annapolis, called the Peggy Stewart, and it's loaded with more than a ton of smuggled British tea in packages labeled as linen. Well, word gets around, and the Sons of Liberty, in the Annapolis style, approach the ship owner, Mr. Stewart, and they tell him to sign a paper stating that he had done wrong in bringing British tea into the colony and that he would destroy his tea. Well, Mr. Stewart talks with his business partners and does him one up. He decides that he's so scared of the men, instead of burning the tea, he burns his whole ship. The second Boston Tea Party. It takes place on March 7th, 1774. Colonel Knowles is confronted by his eastern neighbors in Boston, and it's a day that Governor Hutchinson proclaimed as a day of public fasting. And Governor Hutchinson didn't miss many meals. A band of men, evidently believing that they had located some of the tea from the cheese ship, Williams, that remained, entered the Boston shop of a tea merchant called Davison, Newman & Company, whose tea had been destroyed in the Boston Tea Party, allegedly. Well, they found some tea from the tea ship William, and they took 16 chests of tea down to the harbor, broke them open, and dumped the contents into the water. And it's been referred to since as the Second Boston Tea Party. In Princeton, late January 1774, one night Princeton College students from all the colonies broke into the college's storeroom. This has since happened almost 250 years, still goes on in colleges. But it's described by student Charles Beatty. He says, "We gathered all the steward's winter store of tea, and having made a fire on the campus, We there burned near a dozen pound, tolled the bell, and made many spirited resolves. They also made an effigy of Massachusetts Governor Hutchinson, tied a key tea canister around his neck, and burned it in front of Nassau Hall. Students subsequently continued their agitations, including paying nocturnal visits in groups of 40, dressed in white, to local townspeople rumored to be tea drinkers, seizing their stock of tea and burning it. Greenwich. Another tea party, summer of 1774. Captain of the small ship Greyhound, loaded with East India Company tea, is reluctant to try to unload his shipment in Philadelphia. Just before the Delaware Bay, he puts into Cohansey Creek and anchors at the little hamlet of Greenwich, New Jersey. There he unloaded his cargo, and it was put into the cellar of a loyalist named Daniel Bowen, who intended to have it eventually carried overland into Philadelphia and to sell it there. Well, on the night of December 22nd, 1774, after planning in secret for several months, 40 locals dressed as Indians broke into Bowen's house, carried the cases of tea into a field, dumped the tea in a large pile, and set it ablaze. Those who participated in this tea party were arrested but were not convicted because the jury was in complete sympathy with them. Then in my hometown, Marshfield, the Marshfield Tea Party, December 19, 1773. After the Boston Tea Party, and people in Marshfield always get it 3 days late, the patriots of Marshfield learned that there was a large quantity of tea secreted by some authorities in the cellar of a house known as the Ordinary, which was 200 or 300 feet from the street leading from the First Congregational Church. The Marshfield Patriots marched to the house and demanded the tea. Resistance being useless, it was given up and carried to a rock on a hill directly not far from the First Congregational Church. It was heaped upon a huge rock, subsequently called the Tea Rock, and it was burnt to ashes. The Ordinary was constructed as a tavern in 1673 and is located at 2000 Ocean Street. Marshfield has the largest per capita hair salons and bars. Hair salon bar. After taking the tea, the patriots knelt in prayer and ceremoniously burnt the tea on a large rock and situated on what became known as Tea Rock Hill. Other fires of the Revolution, there was a British coffee house that was mysteriously caught on fire in April of 1772. On April 4th, 1773, a fire originated in the cabinet shop of Mr. Alexander Edwards, located near the Mill Pond. Six or seven other buildings were destroyed by this fire, including the first church built by the Scandinavians that stood at the foot of a lane. And this is the actual article that was printed in the Boston Gazette, referring to the April 4th, 1773 fire. Other fires, August 10th, 1774. If you look at great Boston fires, you have 1676, you have 1711, 1760, and then 1774, and I'm talking just in the 18th century. It's one of the most terrible fires to occur, and it happens on August 10th, about 10:30 at night. It's discovered in a large brick dwelling house located on Fish Street, and it's owned by a Mr. Milliken and Mrs. Campbell. In the lower part of the house was a mass of flames before the occupants of the upper floor were aware of their terrible danger. Several escaped by jumping from the windows, some of whom, being considerably burned, were destitute of clothing, while three women and two children perished in the flames. The house was entirely consumed, and a bakehouse adjoining was badly burned. Hugh Earl Percy, he comes up in just a bit, politely offered the service of some soldiers who could be depended upon, but was told by the rest of the townspeople, "We don't need your help." Some other ones, fires, May 17, 1775. A fire broke out on the south side of town, town dock, in the building occupied as barracks by the British troops. One of the buildings belonged to John Hancock. For 10 days previous, there had been a report circulated that the Liberty Party, the Sons of Liberty, intended to fire the town. And this says a Bostonian, "Soon as I observed the fire, the bells not ringing, I cried fire, but was stopped by a soldier, a British soldier, who said it was against orders, who threatened to knock my brains out if I did not keep still. When I arrived at the fire, there was no engine. I asked the reason of such extraordinary delay, and was told by an engine man that he had been to his engine, but the bayonets were too thick. After the fire had been long raging, the engines finally arrived. 20,000 pounds damage, a large quantity of provisions generously contributed by the patriotic friends of Boston for the relief of the inhabitants. Boston had been sealed off at that point, and people were starving. Then they were laboring under the oppressive port bill. They were also destroyed, and this conflagration originated from the bursting of some cartridges. And before the fire was extinguished, 30 buildings were destroyed. Evacuation Day. The British evacuated the town of Boston on March 17, 1776, but it does not appear they accomplished their work. Several days later, Castle William was burnt to ashes and destroyed. And people think, was that saboteurs, loyalists? Some other fires, just quickly so we can move on here. The bottom one there, fire of January 1778. A fire consumes an edifice located in Frog Lane, which is Boylston Street, built 50 years earlier by Peter Clarendon, but then occupied by John Carter Esquire. The fire originates in one of the chambers about 9 o'clock in the evening on the 15th and burnt so rapidly that very little of the furniture was saved. A barn on the premises was also destroyed, and had it not been that the snow was very deep on the roofs of the houses, a terrible conflagration would have resulted. And some other Boston fires of the Revolution. Couple here. The one is on Wednesday, the bottom one, September 20, 1780, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. A large fire broke out on Long Wharf, which destroyed the warehouses of Pitts and Call and Mr. S. Elliott's tobacco store. Otherwise, the whole range of warehouses would have been consumed if it weren't for the high tide. And finally, one on Pudding Lane, and another one, that's a repeat there. And then finally, 1783, Mr. Riley's store catches fire. It's a gigantic fire. 9 horses perish. A lot of merchandise lost. 2 men, one named Moses Haley, are just in town from Hanover, Mass., with their wives passing by the ruins when a chimney falls, burying the 2 men, killing poor Mr. Haley instantly, and the other man dying the next day. So fires that sparked the American Revolution. Well, I call it the Lexington burnout. Okay? The Punkatasset smoke pall. And the raising of Charlestown. If you're looking for battles and maneuvers and casualty numbers, I'm not going to be giving them to you tonight. I can defer to all the experts. I can see 4 or 5 in this room alone that know more about these campaigns than I do. And finally, the demolition of Boston Light. My sources are the Boston Campaign on the right by Victor Brooks, and of course our D. Michael Ryan, Concord and the Dawn of the Revolution. You see different numbers, you have to settle with some resources, and I'm settling with these two. Again, not talking about maneuvers, folklore, or casualties. Your comments are welcome, so please interject at any time. So we all know about the route out of Boston that the British took, and it, as you can see to the center of the screen, Lexington is where the first meetup.com happens. Amos Doolittle, I'm going to show you 4 plates, but this is the plate number 1 that Amos did, the Battle of Lexington, April 19th, 1775. Apparently there was some sort of gunplay. That's all I can tell you. That's not my focus tonight. Major Pitcairn and Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith reconnoiter in this plate number 2 from Concord's Hilltop Cemetery. It's a view of the town of Concord. And here they recognize the Rebs, the rebels, in the hills regrouping. And you'll see that prior to their occupation of that hill, the rebel contingent was there gathering. I call it the Punkatasset smoke pall. It's really the premise of my lecture tonight. After Prescott warned the town of Concord of the incurring British regulars, church bells rang out after midnight in the village of Concord. So at dawn in Concord, Colonel James Barrett returns to his farm, uncontested. In fact, he comes up against some British soldiers that let him pass, to warn his family that the British are coming to search his property, looking for him. And so he goes and buries munitions in his fields with his sons and then returns to the impending confrontation. Hundreds of Minutemen now and residents are gathered in the town. They march toward the column of approximately 700, I've heard 800, British regulars. Once they sight the advance force, smartly, Colonel James Barrett leads his militia on a retreat to the town's burying ground, then to a place east of the river called Ripley Hill. As he saw that his troops' flanks were exposed, he then led them off of Ripley Hill onto neighboring Punkatasset Hill, which is on the west side of the river and less than a mile from the old North Bridge. This is so he can gather strength. He has approximately 500 at the time, at that time, and the time is about 9 a.m. There are 2 British objectives: destroy weapons and eat breakfast. General Gage's spies had made maps that pointed out several locations of munitions, including approximately 14 cannons and whoever was the rabble-rousers and the leaders. Homes were searched for weapons and food was, quotation fingers, purchased. It was kind of a wimpy from Popeye, I'll pay you on Tuesday. There was no money exchanged.
Aha. Uh-huh.
What do you think, Tom?
I think I'm screwed.
First credit default in America.
Well, they gave some money to Mrs. Barrett, but she refused to keep it.
Okay, so, all right. Okay. So, 3 24-pound cannons were dug up from Ephraim Jones Tavern's backyard. The Brits chopped down the town's Liberty Pole and put it into a pile. They then started a bonfire. Sparks from the bonfire ignited the town's meeting house. Temporarily, redcoats and residents worked together to extinguish the fire. And again, interject whenever you want if you have any questions. According to a British historian, quote, "The grenadiers spoiled some flour, knocked the trunnions off several iron guns, burned a heap of wooden spoons, and cut down a Liberty Pole." And that was it. So what did they miss? 10 tons of musket balls and cartridges, 50 reams of cartridge paper, 31 barrels of flour, over 17 tons of rice, and over 8 tons of dried fish that were scattered throughout the towns of Middlesex County, with significant quantities stored at Barrett's farm. So already, the British operation is a complete failure. Barrett now, seeing smoke, moves his militia 1,000 yards closer to the town's muster field, which is a flat hilltop. As a darker smoke pall rose from Concord Center, Adjutant Lieutenant Joseph Hosmer cried, "Will you let them burn the town down?" After hearing this, Captains William Smith of Lincoln, Captain Isaac Davis of Acton then pleaded with Barrett for a forward advance. Barrett relented, formed up 2 regiments, had them load up, and shouted that his troops would not be the first to fire, but if the British fire first, then fire as fast as you can. As the fifers and drummers played the White Cockade, Lieutenant Colonel John Robinson and Major John Buttrick led the regiments down the hill toward the Old North Bridge. Francis, does Lincoln play that?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Upon seeing this rush, the British fall back to the far side of the river, and they curiously begin to pull up planks. So they're already retreating. The primary objective is forsaken. They tell me that there was some sort of exchange at the North Bridge. Hey, I'm only responsible for getting you to the bridge. And this is plate number 3, Amos Doolittle, the engagement at North Bridge in Concord. So the retreat from Concord and Lexington. British ranking officers, Colonel Francis Smith, not a good officer at all, lazy, slow, trudges along. He has a leg wound, and Major John Pitcairn is thrown by his horse, and he's injured. So the command is in disarray, the orders are unclear, and there's a deadly colonial fusillade that's being unleashed upon them. Well, on comes this Hugh Percy that wanted to help with the fire there a few years ago. Brigadier Hugh Earl Percy finally arrives with an elite force, a relief column, including 2 6-pound field cannons of reinforcements, over 1,000 men or 3 regiments of foot. Percy takes Monroe Tavern as a temporary headquarters. And again, I'm dealing in ambiguities here, not in specifics. They recover Smith's exhausted vanguard in total disarray. And provincial marksmen take up positions in the tree line and behind any natural cover, and they pour sniper fire indiscriminately onto the massing British forces. So I got to participate with George in that Tower Park until my musket jammed and I died. Yeah. Yes?
What I got discovered is there are actually far more trees in Middlesex County now than there ever were back then. It was almost entirely cleared for farms, so there wasn't that much woods to take cover in, as is thought.
Okay,
so it wasn't like Indian fighting, like some people think.
Well, Percy orders the gunners to destroy any homes or buildings suspected of housing these snipers. And what goes up? The town's meeting house and several area homes are pounded by cannon. The Bond's house and barn up in flames. Loring's house, Deacon's house, clockmaker Mulliken's house and workshop containing all of his tools. I count 6 buildings. I've seen 3 buildings. I've heard 4 buildings. I count 6. And I went to the Museum of Natural Heritage. Has everybody been there recently? What a marvelous trip. Go there if you can. What a great museum. Those Masons, they get all the good stuff. 2 ladles by Paul Revere.
Well, he was
Oh, absolutely.
Master Mason.
It's a fantastic museum.
Office. But Clockmaker Mulliken's house, his daughter Lydia was dating Samuel Prescott.
Oh. No, I won't say that. That's why he got on his horse so quickly. The Lexington burnout. So here's a depiction here. If you look to the lower right-hand corner, you can see some of the buildings aflame. During this covering action, the soldiers afoot set barns and hay piles ablaze. They used the smoke haze to maneuver in and reposition to key offensive points to bolster their salient defenses. The British, who had their ammo wagons lagging behind, and also Gage's newly issued ammo wagons that were sent from Boston, were captured in West Cambridge. They're now running out of ammunition. The situation is critical. So without giving you a minute-by-minute detail, there are experts in this room, as I mentioned, who can provide further clarity. The British broke out and were harassed all the way back to Boston and Charlestown. Here's a color rendition of that image that I just showed you.
Let's get see how the trees are almost gone.
Good point, Tom. And this is an engraving by Alonzo Chapel. And this is my favorite. This is what I saw at the National Museum. John Carter Brown... this is his depiction called The Retreat from Lexington to Concord. It was printed in British newspapers, and quote, "The wild Irish asses," because this British contingent was made up of Irishmen, "defeated by the brave American militia." So they were winning sympathy, even over in England. And this is the final plate of Amos Doolittle, which is a view of the south part of Lexington. You can see three distinct areas up in flames. Now we get to the burning of Charlestown. The Raising of Charlestown, the HMS Falcon, Symmetry, Somerset, Glasgow, and Lively. Somerset has a marvelous history behind it. 78 guns total roll quietly in the water as shovels, picks, and spades are at work creating a redoubt atop Breed's Hill. It's about 4:35 a.m. when a lookout on board the HMS Lively spots the entrenchments, quote, "full of the heads of men who were not British." Ship's master Thomas Bishop immediately gives command to bombard the breastworks. Word is sent to Admiral Graves, who orders an immediate ceasefire. He's relieved later on in this year. After viewing the bulwarks through a spyglass from the Christchurch steeple, General Gage, he's enraged, has the orders countermanded and reissues orders to bombard the fortification. And some sort of disagreement, I'm told, takes place on Bunker Hill. Meanwhile, over in Charlestown, General William Howe, in his blood-stained uniform and his personal staff wiped out, gives a controversial order. This order helps General Pigott on the left wing with his grand assault. Battle of Bunker Hill, I'm told here, with all this maneuvering about. When 38 companies under Lieutenant Colonel Robert Pigott were assembling for their role as the left wing in the grand assault, they came under a hellacious crossfire from three colonial militias deployed in abandoned buildings in Charlestown, acting as a screen for Colonel William Prescott's garrison. Charlestown, and it was called the Neck, population had been reduced by 50% recently, down from 4,000 to about 2,000 after April 19th, as many chose to flee Charlestown because the British had retreated there after April 19th to Boston and the surrounding countryside they removed with their valuables. Howe commands Admiral Thomas Graves to unleash a naval barrage upon the Neck to dislodge the contingent of colonial harassers. Graves asks Howe, "Can I use incendiary ammunition, sir?" Howe doesn't object, says whatever. Pigott also wanted to start a house-to-house search as well for the militia and then torch the houses. So Graves says, "Yeah, Pigott, you can light the houses on fire." So Graves sends word to the British fleet to open up on Charlestown with some hot shot. Hot shot refers to heated red-hot cannonballs or carcasses, which are hollow cannonballs filled with burning pitch. A party of Royal Marines from HMS Somerset then sprints onto the eastern section of the Neck and sets fire to buildings that were not hit by the ship bombardment. Then they withdraw. Finally, British troops on nearby Copse Hill pour incendiary projectiles onto Charlestown in a cannon barrage. An eyewitness in Boston, and by the way, spectators stood on the crowded Boston roofs to glimpse the spectacle, quote, "The sky was filled with the blaze of the burning town, fire coursing through whole streets or curling up the spires of public edifices, the air above filled with clouds of dense black smoke." By 2:30 p.m., the ghost town is totally engulfed in fire. Piggott diverts 25% of his attacking force to flush out the remaining snipers who had simply retreated to the burned out shells of Charlestown structures and continually picked off British soldiers. So he weakened the left wing. And you know that's what happened in the von Schlieffen plan in World War I, where they weakened their right wing. So he weakens their wing and actually causes more casualties in the long run for the British and their assault up Breed's Hill. As the colonials who were responsible for rescuing the precious artillery pieces fought to the last man, quote, and were outnumbered 10-1 in places at the end of the melee, most of the fiercest fighting came from the infuriated men who watched their homes burn in Charlestown. By the time the firestorm burns itself out, there was literally no place for it to go on this neck, 380 dwellings are burned. Only about 15 homes remain standing. British General Henry Clinton remarked in his diary that a few more such victories would have surely put an end to British dominion in America. Just some other depictions of the raising of Charlestown. You can see in this one here, that ship is the one that's pouring hot shot. Well, it's recently hitting the redoubt on Breed's Hill, but pouring hot shot into Charlestown. Another sketch here showing the landing parties and those columns of British soldiers. I like this one. This is from Barnard's History of England that was published in the 18th century, showing Charlestown ablaze. The death of Joseph Warren, and you always see any Bunker Hill photo, you see this black smoke ball coming up. It's always the sun blotted out. And as we know, this is a very hot day. And this is from the Mass Historical Society, another 18th century engraving. And this is one also, a painting that was done actually in the early 19th century. How are we doing for time, Steve?
Yeah, you have a big timer right there.
Okay, exactly. Okay, I'm 35. Okay. Boston Light. Has everybody been to Boston Light? Raise your hand if you have. Okay, I recommend it if you can. Obviously in the summer on a calm day, because there'll be like a whale watch out in the Antarctic if you're not careful. But wonderful trip. It's the first lighthouse built on the site, and it dates back to 1716, so it's the first lighthouse in the colonies. The current lighthouse dates from 1783. It's the second oldest working lighthouse in the U.S. I believe Sandy Hook in New Jersey is the oldest working lighthouse. And the first keeper of Boston Light was George Worthylake, who drowned along with his wife and daughter when returning to the island in 1718. Tough life. On June 1st, 1774, the Boston Port Bill, referred to by the colonists as the Intolerable Acts, went into effect, forbidding any cargo to be imported or exported from the Port of Boston. Well, the Battle of Bunker Hill took place on Breed's Hill on June 17, 1775, and Boston Light became part of the action. In June 1774, the British occupied Boston, and the light passed into their hands. Now, you don't need a lighthouse if the harbor's sealed off. On July 20th and again on July 31st, the Americans dismantled the station and burned the wooden parts of the tower and the buildings. And here's from Patriot Samuel Bixby's diary in 1775. Quote, August 1st, yesterday we had a fight with the regulars down at the lighthouse. We killed a considerable number of them, made prisoners of 35 regulars and 7 Tories, burnt 2 schooners, 1 house and 1 barn, sank 1 barge, and took a great deal of plunder. So, you know, there was equal destruction on both sides. And again, once the Port of Boston was closed on July 20th, 1775, a small troop of American soldiers under the leadership of Major Vose was diverted from a mission to harvest the grain in the town of Hull, thus preventing the British from doing so. They were sent out to Little Brewster Island, where their instructions were to destroy the wooden parts of the lighthouse, which they did, by torching it after dismantling the light apparatus. Upon their return to Hull, they were fired upon by a British schooner. However, Vose's troops were able to outmaneuver the schooner and reach safety. Fotheringham quoted an eyewitness in his siege of Boston saying that, quote, the flames of the lighthouse ascending up to heaven like grateful incense and the ships wasting their powder. And in the summer of 1775, Major Ben Tapper, with a party of men, went from Milton and set fire to the lighthouse, which destroyed the woodwork and the glass, immediately after which it was repaired by the order of Admiral Graves, who at that time commanded the British Navy. When the necessary repairs were completed, he stationed a guard of 50 Marines there in order to protect it. In the month of September in the same year, Major Tupper with a small band went again to the lighthouse in whaleboats, set fire to that and all the other buildings on the island, and made prisoners of the guard together with a number of craftsmen. Admiral Graves once more had it repaired, the lamps lighted, and another guard posted there, which continued until June of 1776, when a Captain Bangs, commander of King England's ship, the Renown, of 50 guns, which was then among a number of other vessels driven out of Nantasket Road by the Americans, went to the island, took off the guard, and left a quantity of powder, which took fire and blew up the building about an hour after his departure. So, in June of 1776, the British, evacuating Boston, landed at the light station and blew up the tower and subsequently the old top of the lighthouse. And the Americans used the metalwork for lanterns, and they also supplied the cannel with ladles. And then John Hancock, basically, this says he asked the Boston Marine Society to, in the Senate and the House of Representatives, to build a lighthouse there. It's critical for the future of Boston. Some major fires. If we look at the major fires of the Revolution, we have the destruction of Falmouth. The Wallace, what was that? Falmouth is Falmouth, Maine.
Portland, Maine now.
Right, yes, Portland, Maine. The Wallace bombardments, the sacking of Norfolk, Virginia, something I call Burgoyne's farce, the Great New York Fire, that's the first Great New York Fire, the Great Charleston Fire, other Great Charleston Fires, the Dark Day, and then burning of New London. So, it's October 18th, 1775. And Captain Henry Moat, a cocky man, begins a naval bombardment with incendiary shot and then follows it up with a landing party. But backing up, Moat gets permission from Vice Admiral Graves, who we spoke of earlier, who had ordered Moat's expedition to go up and down the coast and seize the port of Falmouth and capture any ships that are carrying supplies for the Boston rebels. So the orders come, and Graves orders Moat to, quote, lay waste, burn, and destroy such seaport towns as are accessible to His Majesty's ships, and particularly Machias, which is way up on the main coast, where a ship called the Margarita was seized. Huh. Moat assembles a fleet of four ships, the Canso, the Symmetry, the Spitfire, and the Halifax, and he sails out of Boston Harbor on October 6th. Well, his instructions were very broad. He was originally going to attack Cape Ann, but he decided not to because the homes were so spread out. So he arrives in Falmouth, and he sends a proclamation ashore. He says, you have 2 hours to evacuate Portland, surrender all of your arms, or I'm going to lay the town to waste. And as soon as they received this ultimatum, the townspeople sent out a deputation to plead with Moat for mercy. He promised to withhold his fire if the town swore an oath of allegiance to King George. Well, everybody says, we're not going to do that. We're not going to surrender our small arms. And they begin to evacuate. So they did get a small number of muskets. But Moat set a deadline of 9 a.m. for the town's response. It's 9:40. He hasn't heard anything. So he runs a red flag up the Canso's masthead. That's the ship he's on. And he orders the fleet to begin firing. They fire incendiary cannonballs, and they set fire to the harbor installations and most of the town's public buildings. And this is an eyewitness, quote, the firing began from all the vessels with all possible briskness, discharging on all parts of the town, a horrible shower of balls from 3 to 9 pounds weight, bombs, carcasses, as we spoke of, live shells, grape shot, and musket balls. The firing lasted with little cessation until 6 o'clock. So you're talking all day, 9 hours.
What about hot shot?
A bombardment.
Some hot shot in there?
Yep, absolutely. Carcasses, yep.
Well, that's what they are.
They're filled with burning pitch. So when the bombardment appears to be inadequate, he sends a landing party in to torch any buildings that survive. And unfortunately, though, and I'll show you, there's another engravement of the destruction of Falmouth. It turned out to be a failure. Even though they destroyed 400 buildings and houses were recorded as damaged or destroyed by fire, Moat also stated that 11 small vessels were destroyed in the harbor, 4 captured at the cost of 1 of his men killed and 1 wounded. Unfortunately for Portland, they were left to fend themselves off for the winter terrible winter for them, 75 and 76. In fact, the Massachusetts Provincial Congress authorized 250 pounds to send food and relief up to Portland after the British evacuated. But this was a mistake by Moat, because it eventually hurt his military career, and it also hurt the career of Admiral Graves, because it didn't do anything. Portland still stood, and they had severe damage to their ships. Yes, Larry.
John, does everybody know that was Massachusetts at that time?
Maine was.
Falmouth was Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So actually, I could say Falmouth, Massachusetts, huh?
And really confuse people.
Exactly.
It was 1820 when they separated.
Oh, okay. Did not know that. Here's the bombardment of Falmouth. What I want to point out to you is this. Do you see this white area? This is basically where that had all the heavy fire destruction. My brother lives right over here. And again, as I mentioned, it wasn't really a success. There's a depiction of Moat. Following the bombardment, Moat went up to Booth Bay, which is just north of Portland, where he set fire to a few houses, raided them for livestock, but his expedition was faltering to an end. The decks of some of the ships had been inadequately braced for his prolonged gunnery, and many of his guns had jumped their mounts. He returns to Boston and remained there as winter was setting in. Admiral Graves is now relieved in December of 1775 because these punitive raids were not working, and they were gradually abandoned. And this action brought Maine, a.k.a. Massachusetts, into the Revolution full heart and soul. Yes?
That's an interesting term. What happens when a gun, being a cannon, jumps its mount exactly on a ship?
I think it was overfired. You know, when he's firing for 9 rounds, these guns are probably designed, again, I'm just speculating here, is that probably they're only designed for maybe a dozen, 2 dozen, 3 dozen rounds. He probably fired 100 rounds, and they were probably scalding hot and buckled the wood underneath them and popped them out.
Cool.
That's what I guess.
You know, in Concord, when they fire their historic cannon, like they did Patriots Day, they have to wait a certain time between firings.
See,
like
that's
state law for safety.
Only one shot?
One shot.
See?
So then they probably could do a couple of shots, and then they had to let them cool.
I know in the Civil War.
Loading, that's why you yeah.
In the Civil War, Southerners were made to mount the cannon. I'll let you think about what that means when they were captured. The Wallace bombardments. August 30th, 1775, Royal Naval Captain James Wallace, commanding the HMS Rose, fires into the town of Stonington, Connecticut. After the townspeople there prevented Rose's tender from capturing a vessel that it had chased into the harbor. Apparently not seeking to burn the town down, he did not fire any heated rounds. He also fires in the town of Bristol, Rhode Island, in October of 1775, after its townspeople refused to deliver livestock to him. So they're big men sitting off in their ships, lobbing shells into the towns. The destruction of Norfolk. Another pompous man by the name of Lord Dunsmore was the last royal governor of the colony of Virginia. Mm-hmm. Norfolk, Virginia, is a loyalist stronghold. And basically what happens is the Battle of Kemp's Landing in November of 1775 is a big victory for Dunsmore and the Loyalists and the British. Well, he gets a little cocky. He sets up a stronghold and he demolishes some 30 houses and gets the people very upset. And what's happened on December 9th, 1775, the Battle of the Great Bridge occurs. And an advance guard of 600 soldiers that Dunmore sent to eliminate the rebel position were lured into a causeway which formed a narrow killing zone. And there, they were hit with a crossfire by regiments from a young regiment out of Virginia, a regiment from North Carolina. 102 men were killed out of the 600 there, and only one injured from the Colonials. It drove Dunmore and his men back to their ship called the Otter. So Dunmore demands guarding colonel there to let him come ashore to plunder and get food and take provisions on. They say, we're going to keep shooting until you sail away. So he decides to begin a bombardment, concentrating on the waterfront. And this lasts 7 hours. British troops are sent ashore to burn down all the waterfront buildings, and thus they play right into the hands of the enemies. The rebels were quite happy to see a large loyalist city destroyed completely, happier still to be able to blame it on the British. And over the next 2 days, they encouraged the spread of fires while looting unburned houses. So in May, here's the interesting part. So they saw Tory houses, loyalist houses, and they decided to loot them. In May of 1777, 882 houses were burned. Only 19 were set ablaze by the British. A further 416 that were remained standing were destroyed in February of 1776, so they rebuilt Norfolk only to have it burned down again. And there's Lord Dunmore. And that's where Norfolk is located. And basically, in quote, and this is where wind fans the fire to flame. The Norfolk sky turned flaming red and then cloudy with updrafts of blowing soot. A frigid wind carried a shower of burning coals inland from the waterfront, setting afire the roofs of more than 800 dwellings and buildings. Before the end of February 1776, more than 400 other structures were burned, leaving 6,000 homeless and inspiring a line in the Declaration of Independence.
So the Americans done more burning than Dunmore.
There you go. This is I put this fuchsia because whenever Gentleman Johnny Burgoyne puts up a play, you have to put fuchsia behind it. Sorry. January 8th, 1776.
I like that.
He's too good. January 8th, a performance of British General Johnny Burgoyne's farce, The Blockade of Boston, was ironically interrupted by the announcement that some American troops were conducting a raid. The audience mistakenly thought that the announcement was made by an actor dressed in the uniform of a Continental Army sergeant, which marked the opening of the play. It wasn't. It was a Continental Army sergeant. The raid led by, then they go on raid, they led by Major Thomas Knowlton, succeeded in capturing 5 British prisoners and burning 8 houses. Knowlton's force did not suffer any casualties. American victory.
Yes.
Yes.
We whipped them good.
The first great fire of New York, and I think I'm going to wrap up with this, and we'll try to get there. I know that we're running on time here, and I don't want to keep you here, especially on a great playoff night as such. Some of George Washington's advisors suggested burning New York City as a defensive measure. One of the great things about His Excellency George Washington was his patience and his inability to attack. And he wanted to attack New York so bad, and he never did. And what happened on, he abandoned the city on September 12, 1776, 3 days later, the British occupied it. And what happened on the 21st, at about 1 a.m., at the Fighting Cox Tavern, a fire breaks out near Whitehall Slip. And it broke out in a wooden house. With the help of a strong wind, the fire quickly spreads north. An hour later, a change in the wind direction confines the area between Broadway Street and the Hudson River. In the end, almost 500 houses are destroyed, 493 to be exact. And the British accused the Americans of starting the fire. It starts in an American tavern after midnight. Nah. And what happened was the city's firemen had been evacuated previously with Washington, okay? There's a lot of raised eyebrows here. The Trinity Church was destroyed. There were 3 separate fires that began over the course of September 20th through the 21st and 22nd. But what happened is the colonists hid or sabotaged the fire engines. They removed the fire bells and church bells, making it difficult to sound an alarm. Fire buckets lacked handles or the bottoms were slashed. Again, they were leather. When fire struck, the volunteer firefighters who tried to battle the blaze were hindered and attacked by British and Hessian soldiers. The brutality of the soldiers caused the death of one Peter Room, and a third of the city was destroyed. So Washington mused that some honest patriot might have helped them out by setting the fire. The British were also convinced that the fire had been deliberately set. What they did is they arrested 200 suspected sympathizers. Amongst them was the self-described American spy, Nathan Hale, who was hung. Anyways, the displaced citizens ended up living in tents for the next several months and throughout that winter in New York.
And most of it would be Tories?
Yes.
New York was famous for that.
Correct. Here's another woodcut. Shows the burning of New York, the first great fire. This the first great fire, I call this, because the second great fire was the fire of 1835. The third great fire was the P.T. Barnum fire of 1841. And again, this is a famous, it's in Dutch. If you look at the Dutch writing below, New Amsterdam was settled as Newton. In fact, the first fire in New York was 1613. One of the first ships to land, called the Tiger, caught on fire. So New York's had a history ever since it was settled. Again, that's just more enhancement of that color one. Stick figures, they look like aliens there. whole town's ablaze. And again, this area here, the gray area, this shows you where the fire of 1776 took out Manhattan. Charleston, we're in the home stretch. We're going to get through this, everybody. It's January 15, 1778. A devastating blaze wipes out over half of the city, including the original Huguenot Church, 250 dwellings, stores, warehouses, and the Charleston Library Society, with 6,000 precious volumes lost forever. The fire starts in a kitchen house at the corner of Union and Queen Streets, burns toward Meeting Street, and spreads down Union Street, east towards Broad. I don't know Charleston, so these street names mean nothing to me. And all the way through. Anyways, losses of $3 million, and British loyalists are suspected. In 1779, another huge fire destroys much of the rebuilt city. This time, the colonials are suspected. Some other great fires in Charleston. A powder magazine explodes between Archdale and Mazick. 200 people are killed. 60 are burned beyond recognition. An eyewitness, and I hate to say this, reports that human limbs are hanging from trees and torsos writhing on the street. Also, a brothel was destroyed. 1740, Charleston was almost completely lost due to conflagration, and also in 1700. And then their first fire company formed in 1784. Other Charleston fires, this is basically in May of 1778, some fire shot fired through into the town when they drained the canal. I just want to go through this quickly. New England's dark day, I don't have time to get into this, but basically I'm going to cut to the chase. It's May 19, 1780. All that week, pieces of burnt leaves are continually falling, and rainwater in southern New Hampshire is covered with some sort of scummy soot. On the Piscataquag River, it's 6 inches deep in some places. The air had been very thick and heavy with smoke in some areas that week. From Monday of that week, May 15th, 1780, through Thursday the 18th, a hill in Melrose could not be seen from 2 miles away, and the sun seemed to be unusually red. This is one called Preternatural Darkness. Richard Devins put it in his Our First Century book. Basically, they're saying that it lasted 14 hours in the Boston area. Candles were lit in houses. Birds were singing their evening songs, and then became silent. And then the fowls returned to roost, and the cocks were crowing all around as if it was the break of day. Objects could not be distinguished but at very little distance. Everything looked like it was night. Of course, people, and I'll cut through the text here, people thought that the end of the world was coming. It's for sure, this is it. They were all familiar with Scripture and the text of the Bible, and they flocked to churches. Revelations they were quoting, Joel, the sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and terrible day of the Lord come. Revelations, the sun became as black as sackcloth of hair and the moon became as blood. Even in Yale, President Timothy Dwight, Yale getting it wrong again, I'm sorry. It was the general opinion that the day of judgment was at hand. Score for Harvard. When asked about the cause of the preternatural darkness, a New England minister retorted, I'm as much in the dark as you are. Dark day sermons and proclamations became bestsellers. If Cotton Mather were around, he would have cleaned up, putting out his hand.
About pastors did, and they gathered these together as a collection, and they actually had the governor proclaiming days of prayer.
Wow. Noontime, windows were open and a candle cast a shade. 1 o'clock, there's a glint of light. As I mentioned, it's just very, very dark. 11 o'clock, the darkness is such to demand our attention. Large print could not be read by persons of good eyes without a candle. This is my guy here, Vieter. Out of all the research I've done on dark days since Back to the Crucifixion, this guy finally gets it. He's a correspondent for the Independent Chronicle. He's in the tavern. Okay, he's throwing a few back. But his own observations are in Ipswich. And several of his friends are gentlemen of liberal education. And he notes that the hemisphere for several days had been greatly obscured with smoke and vapor, so that the sun and moon appeared unusually red. The sun rises red in color on May 19th, and then the clouds thicken and blot it out. He says, between 8 and 9 o'clock, the sun was quite shut in, and it began to shower. This is another depiction of New England's dark day. Sorry to go so fast. So he thought that a powerful storm was approaching from the southwest. The sky churned and boiled at higher altitudes, but nearly a blade of grass stirred at ground level, which tells you that it's not a storm. Smoke pall. There's no wind. From the thickness of the clouds and the confusion which attended their motions, they expected a violent gust of wind and rain. But it never came. Over the next several hours, his companions conduct a series of experiments with candles and shadows and newsprint, and they observed that even in front of a bank of windows, 72 panes in all, large print could not be read by persons of good eyes. 1 o'clock in the afternoon, the last glint of light before the sky is extinguished, and the darkness becomes greater than it had been for any time before. A strange luminescence appears in the west. The motion of the clouds in the western sky are now more quick, their color higher and more brassy than any time before. In September of 1883, there's a yellow day that takes place. September 6th, 1883, a yellow day takes place in New England, and it's the same cause as this, and we'll get there in just a moment. At 3 o'clock, they go outside, and they perceive a strong sooty smell. Some of the company were confident that a chimney in the neighborhood must be burning. Others conjectured that the smell was more that like that of burnt leaves. So meanwhile, while everybody in Boston is running into churches praying, these guys are putting their pints down and making scientific observations outdoors. Again, he says, the water gave the same strong sooty smell we had observed in the air and confirmed to me, in my opinion, that it was occasioned by the smoke or very small particles of burnt leaves, which had obscured the hemisphere for several days past and were now brought down by the rain. And this is what he thought. This guy's right on. The vast body of smoke from the woods, which had been burning for many days, mixed with the common exhalations from the earth and water, may perhaps be sufficient causes to produce the surprising darkness. That's another. So a blood moon, I'm not going to go through this, but there is a blood moon, which, again, freaks out the people because they see blood moon in Scripture. This guy, Colonel Abraham Davenport. While everybody else is running around to the end of the world and waiting for the end times, he basically, the legislature of Connecticut's in session, and he says, quote, that I am against, they want to adjourn. Abraham Davenport says, I am against an adjournment. The day of judgment is either approaching or it is not. If it is not, then there is no cause for an adjournment. If it is, I choose to be found doing my duty. I wish, therefore, that candles may be brought. So if it's the end of the world, I want to be working. And again, what's the cause? You got it. From about the 1st of May, great tracts of forest along Lake Champlain down to Fort Ticonderoga were set on fire. Do you remember earlier how I told you about chopping those trees down? New settlers in the northern New Hampshire area along the Canadian border were burning over forests to prepare them for cultivation. They selected the land to be cleared and blazed the trees along its border. Then during each winter, they'd cut the trees down halfway at breast high. The strong winds of March would knock down some of the trees. Instead of waiting for spring, some choppers would fall the trees against each other in a domino effect to knock them down. After a while, the whole trees full of combustible material would be in vast slash piles. So in late April or early May, when the limbs and boughs were dry, they would be ignited, and they would burn for weeks at a time until the logs were turned into ashes. And again, fire served two purposes. It cleared land, and it served as great fertilizer. Well, lo and behold, a couple of years ago, some Australian geology students are digging in a forest in central Ontario. When they come across these tree rings and they find out that there was a major forest fire, they can get it down to the year and the season in the spring of 1780.
Wow.
And then a historian comes and says, spring of 1780, that's the dark day. So if you look at this legend and the wind, there it is out of the southwest. Okay, so the smoke pall probably hooked around with a low pressure system. Okay, and all of these towns had some sort of, Philadelphia didn't have it, but Morristown, New Jersey had a few clouds, Hartford and Boston, so the smoke pall came all the way across Boston, and that's what caused the dark day. That's what caused the yellow day. There was a dark day in Detroit, Michigan in 1752. There's been dark days throughout time. And again, the studies of the tree rings showed that there was a fire.
That's cool.
Yeah,
it's right there.
Yeah. Amazing. And the people had said it was an eclipse and this and that. And 1780 is known as the greatest fire year ever recorded in North America until 1850. Fire dates based on the tree rings. They also know that there were several other major forest fires in the Algonquin Highlands of southern Ontario, where this one was, western Maryland, western Virginia, the Missouri Ozark Highlands, the Boston Mountains of Arkansas, and in the boundary waters of northern Minnesota. So that's what caused the dark day. And just closing on the burning of New London, basically Benedict Arnold, who was one of my favorite generals, he helped us win the Revolution. make no bones about it. And
if he had died at the end of the Battle
Larry's
of Saratoga, there'd be statues of him
everywhere. Oh, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, talk about bravery. Larry's an expert on it, but he was a brave, brave man, Larry.
He didn't do much for the Brits when he switched over.
No, he didn't. No, I mean, what he did is he got the New Londoners enraged. And quickly, I'm just going to tell, it's dawn, September 6, 1781. Arnold leads 800 regular British soldiers into New London. There's also another attacking party on two forts that form the mouth of New London. There's a great, you see down below here, I encourage you, if you get to johnhorgan.com, if you want to write this down, New London Fire 1781.mp3. Sally Rogers is a historian I visited last summer, had a wonderful time in New London. She talked about Benedict Arnold in 45 minutes about this fire with exquisite detail. johnhorgan.com, with the bug is not included. New London Fire 1781.mp3. Marvelous story. If you want the real story, the real of that, download that. But basically, he went in there and the destruction gets out of hand. A store of gunpowder explodes, which provides a huge boost to the original conflagration. They were just burning stores. New London, as you know, was known as a haven for privateers, pirates that were attacking British shipping. And by the time Arnold withdraws his soldiers, more than 140 buildings were ablaze. That's the brief Arnold story in New London. Larry, do you want to add anything to it based upon your research of Benedict Arnold? But the funny thing is that Arnold's name is still invoked whenever the city is under siege. In the hurricane in 1938, New London went up in flames. In fact, people huddled on the beaches in Rhode Island could see the glow of the fire in Connecticut. But when an urban renewal in the 1960s and 70s leveled block after block, Arnold was jokingly called the godfather of New London urban planning. And this is a good painting that depicts the burning of New London. The death of Colonel William Ledyard, Fort Trumbull. And I'm just going to wrap up here tonight with the Lockheed Haze. Ben Franklin pictured in the upper left-hand corner. It's a dark day. There's a strange haze. It's unseasonably cold. It would happen again in New England in 1816 in what was known as the Year Without a Summer, where a volcano in the Philippines known as Tambora went off. It snowed on Boston Common, 3 inches of snow on June 7th, 1816. And the Lockheed Haze wiped out a lot of crops, especially through Europe. You can see some of the where it was seen on the days of June 1783. And it was Ben Franklin who said, this looks like it came from a volcano in Iceland. And people laughed and laughed, and it came from a volcano in Iceland. And then just to close here, Napoleon.
How did he know that? I'm sorry. Wait a
Judging on where it had come from, and I believe, Tom, that he had come across the sea in a ship, and he might have seen DePaul from Europe. Right. Yeah. Brilliant man. Genius. The first quality of a soldier is constancy in enduring fatigue and hardship. Courage is only secondary. And finally, here's my premise, and we wrap it up. Quote, this is me. The deliberate and barbaric burning of several colonial cities by the British ignited the American Revolution and helped spark the Continental Army onto victory. The utter loathing of an attacking enemy incites a defender to fight for his home, his family, and his very being. The ability of the 13 colonies to endure fire sieges made them more resilient and resistant to British domination. That's my talk for tonight. Thank you, everybody.
Gotta write a book. Gotta write a book. Nowhere else is that information all together. That there is a book there.
Yep.
Definitely.
Okay, thank you, John, very much.
Your spare time, John.
Beth, do you have anything you need to say?
I think you go first. I'm speaking about...